Draper was an established Washington, D.C.-based reporter. He had a dramatic sweep of blonde hair, a slight Texas accent, and a seen-everything confidence. Pascal Maitre was a gentlemanly veteran photojournalist who lived in Paris with his family but spent much of his time on the road. He'd covered stories all over Africa and had been to Somalia several times before. The two men had arrived in Mogadishu 3 days ahead of us, having hired a Jos in advance as their fixer. Encountering them in the Shamo dining room, I was both starstruck and a little miffed. A Jos, it became clear, would be working primarily for the Geographic guys, spending his days accompanying them as they did their reporting, leaving Nigel and me with the mild-mannered, not terribly experienced Abdi. It turned out that a Jos had hired another man to work with Abdi and serve as the translator for us, but just hours before our arrival, the guy had quit, saying it was too dangerous to be seen with white people in Mogadishu. Abdi thus had been thrust into the triple role of cameraman, translator, and junior fixer. When I asked Pascal, the photographer, for a rundown on what they'd done during their time in Somalia, thinking it might give us some ideas, he declined to tell me. He was kind but firm. "I am sorry," he said in a thick French accent. "If I told you where we went and then you went there yourselves, you would be running a huge risk. In Somalia, you can't do the same thing twice. They will catch you." By "you," he meant foreigners. By "they," he meant both Al-Shabaab and the roving, less organized militias, all of whom might want to snatch us. I liked Pascal for his straightforwardness. He was guarding his own stories, but he seemed sincere in his worries for our safety, too. He and Robert struck me as hard-working journalists intent on doing their jobs and wasting no time. They were in Somalia for 10 days. Next to them, I was certain that we appeared inexperienced, underfunded, and a bit directionless. If that was their opinion, though, they kindly kept it to themselves. "Keep your wits about you," Pascal told us before he headed to bed that first night, "and listen to what a Jos tells you." A Jos Sanura had dark skin, rectangular glasses, and a serious manner. He was constantly on his cell phone, seeming to have friends all over the city, people whom he plied continuously for news. Somalis, he explained, loved to talk, to trade gossip. In a city with no infrastructure, where impromptu street battles went on almost daily, where allegiances were always shifting, the mobile phone was, for its citizens, something of a lifeline. News spread rapidly and informally, traveling over vast family networks, cousin to cousin to cousin. "Don't go to Bakara Market today," they'd say, or, "There was gunfire near the K4 intersection just now. 2 women died and 1 soldier was hurt." A Jos made it his business to tap into as many of these networks as possible. He kept his pockets stuffed with cash, parsing out tips, bribes, and favors at will, cultivating contacts among rival militias inside the government and outside the city limits. He had friends from every faction, Al-Shabaab friends, Ethiopian military friends, friends in the transitional government and in various clans. The idea being that when he had journalists in town, he could secure interviews, track down news, or arrange for safe passage over roads patrolled by violent militias. On his left wrist, he wore a heavy gold watch. A Jos was about 40, had a wife and 10 children. He lived with his family in a house in a different part of the city, but when he worked with foreigners, he stayed in a room at the Shamo Hotel. Meeting me and Nigel for breakfast the following morning, he addressed our worries, speaking fluid English, assuring us that he would take good care of us from afar, that he would remain in constant touch with Abdi while he himself went off to work with the Geographic guys. All the while, his phone rang, his legion of unseen informants checking in one after another with their morning reports. Working with white people in Somalia was a risky but profitable undertaking. Nobody took it lightly. A Jos had gotten his start in 1993 when he was hired to help a visiting BBC cameraman carry his tripod around town. Before that, he'd been eking out a living waiting tables at the restaurant in the Shamo. Since then, he'd done well financially working as a fixer, though his business, like that of the hotel, was tailing off drastically due to the rising danger. 2 journalists he'd been working with had been killed, both times, he said, because they'd failed to heed his advice. a female producer with the BBC, had been shot in 2005 while waiting outside, ill-advisedly, Ajo said, for her car to pull up in front of the Hotel Sahafi. The second death happened in 2006 when a Swedish cameraman ignored Ajo's warnings, wandered into a crowd at a political demonstration, and was promptly shot in the back by a teenage boy. The losses seemed to weigh heavily on Ajos. True to his word, Ajos issued strident orders about where we could and couldn't go around Mogadishu, based on his incoming phone calls. On our second morning, when we wanted to visit a camp for internally displaced people west of the city, his sources told him it wasn't a good time to travel that particular road. He offered no details on why, but we understood that his judgment was not to be questioned. The city and its roads, after all, were a patchwork of competing fiefdoms. Moving around with Abdi and our two armed government guards, I felt continually on edge. Shamo guests were transported in the hotel's fleet of gleaming Mitsubishi Pajeros, big dark-windowed SUVs that sped conspicuously through the streets, hiding our faces but announcing our presence not just to everyone we passed, but to every cousin and cousin's cousin who subsequently might get a phone call. There are foreigners living at the Shamo. On the second day, we visited two feeding centers run by the World Food Program in Mogadishu. Nigel and I both took photographs. Abdi toted a rented video camera and filmed my interviews with Somalis who'd left their homes due to the fighting or the scarcity of food, or often a combination of both. This was the first time I'd seen true desperation. People who were not just hungry, but starving. Inside the gates of the feeding center, the WFP staff stirred giant vats of steaming lentil soup and a thin millet porridge, while about 1,000 people waited in disorderly lines outside, the men in one line, the women in another. Each person held an empty tin or plastic pail. I noticed listless, knob-kneed children sitting at the feet of many of the women, their bald heads looking too large for their bodies. A few kids clustered in the shade provided by the wheel well of a rusted-out, stripped-down car body that looked like it had been marooned in the sand for years. Because of the fighting, because of the pirates on the ocean and the bandits on the road, food shipments came in sporadically. There were days when people turned up, only to be sent away. When the gates opened, those who'd been waiting rushed forward. The noise amplified. Government soldiers used batons and tree switches to hold back the crowd. Children wailed. The men pushed and brawled their way toward the front, while the women in line remained poised in single file. Once they reached the feeding vats, the men were given 3 ladlefuls of food, the women got 2, the children 1. Their pails loaded, many of them dropped to their knees on the spot and started shoveling food into their mouths, fueling themselves for the walk home. Most weren't headed back to their own neighborhoods, explained the WFP staffer who was hosting us, but rather to makeshift squatter settlements that had sprung up along roadsides where the fighting was less intense, where their access to food was better. I'd say it was like watching a movie, or standing at the side of something so fast-moving and incomprehensible that it didn't seem real. But it wasn't quite that way. It was a toe dipped in the river of other people's misery. It was upsetting, confusing. I was removed from it, but I was also there. I was taking notes, writing a script in my head as Abdi filmed, thinking, believing, that I could help do something about it. Back in our room at the Shamo, I wrote up my weekly column for the Red Deer Advocate. It was not National Geographic or even France 24. It was a newspaper with a circulation of about 13,000, read by people on the faraway Canadian flatlands. I don't know if my column meant anything to anyone besides my dad and Perry, who sent me emails after each one ran in the Saturday paper, but it meant something to me. I had turned in 700 new words and a handful of fresh photos every Friday from March right through August, like clockwork. I'd sent columns from Baghdad, from Addis, and from Nairobi. I loved the discipline imposed by the regular deadline. I loved learning how to write. I was getting better at translating what I saw into words. Going through my notes and the research file on my laptop, I worked up a story that described Mogadishu's beauty and its desolation. I wrote about how a combination of war, lack of rain, and inflation had made food expensive and difficult to come by. I described the crowds lined up outside the feeding center and the danger that families faced just navigating the streets. I described a woman I'd interviewed, Halimo, who'd walked with her family to Mogadishu from central Somalia after one of her children died of starvation. I wrote the story in a frenzy, weaving in the official statistics I'd written down during my interviews with the World Food Program employees. The meaning and magnitude of the numbers were hard to grasp, even as I'd seen some of the living proof. More than 3 million Somalis going hungry. 1 in 6 children malnourished. Sitting on the bed, propped up with pillows, I finished the column, revised it a few times, and then picked a few photos from the feeding center to upload along with it. The Wi-Fi connection at the Shamo was slow and spotty. About 10 minutes into the upload, the signal dropped and I got a failure message. I tried again, and then another time, and still again, each time watching the bar on the screen creep upward and abruptly freeze. I heaved a loud sigh. It was now Friday evening. Back in Canada, the newspaper would soon go to press. Nigel and I were served a feast for dinner that night. In the hotel restaurant, a handsome young waiter delivered bowls of creamy fish soup, followed by a plate holding a whole grilled fish for us to share, followed by fresh lobster juiced with lime. We ate as much and as long as we could, drinking glasses of mango juice as we went. The waiter brought spaghetti. He brought a plate of goat meat, a bunch of bananas, and a basket of bread rolls. When at last we waved him off, he carried out a last plate of sliced papaya spears and offered to pour tea. Afterward, while Nigel settled in the lounge area and watched the Beijing Olympics on television with some of the hotel staff, I returned to our room and tried another time to send my email and the attachments. Another failure message popped up on the screen. I hit the send button again and again. Late that night, knowing the deadline had passed, I made one last effort. This time the connection held. I watched the loading bar on the computer screen tick forward until, after 15 minutes, it showed 100% transmission. My column and photographs lifted out into the world. The story would be published a couple of days later, in Monday's Advocate, under the headline, "Nowhere is a Person Safe in Somalia." At that point, I myself would be walking proof of this. By Monday, nobody would know where I was. Chapter 16. Taken. Later, they would tell me they'd been watching the hotel. They knew we were there. They didn't know who exactly they'd catch, but they were aware that there were foreigners at the hotel. What happened was planned, to the extent anything like this can be planned. Guns had been marshaled, men hired, a place to take us afterward had been secured. Knowing we were coming, they'd laid their trap. Maybe it was a cousin's cousin who tipped them off. Maybe it was the sight of our freshly washed SUV ripping around the old city that caused people to ask questions, to wonder if we could make them rich. Most assuredly, there was cash promised to somebody, a driver, a hotel employee, a guard, in exchange for word of where the foreigners were headed that day. Somebody, we don't know who, sold us out. Nigel woke that morning, Saturday, the 23rd of August, and put on a pink paisley shirt and a pair of designer jeans. We'd been sleeping on the far edges of our king-size bed at the Shamo. We were both tense. He was sending emails to his girlfriend in Scotland. I'd had a call from the American bureau chief in Baghdad with whom I'd had the affair. Though Nigel and I were most definitely not a couple, we hadn't figured out how to be friends either. As colleagues, we were at least trying. During our first 2.5 days in Somalia, we'd seen only a little of what we'd hoped to, hampered by the safety concerns, waiting for the Canadian Navy to arrive with a food shipment. We'd visited the old city, one of the few relatively secure parts of Mogadishu, where abandoned Italian colonial villas sat moldering in the heat, their drained swimming pools suggestive of a better past. We'd gone to a hospital whose rooms were crowded with gunshot victims and amputees. Every step we took, any time we got out of the car, our hired guards trailed behind us, Kalashnikovs strapped over their shoulders. Not entirely uninterested, but not exactly vigilant. With a strong sun already blasting through the window and roosters crowing from outside, I watched Nigel wind a purple scarf around his neck and reach for his oversized silver aviator-style sunglasses with blue lenses. He was about to head off to meet a Ugandan minesweeping unit with Abdi. I had decided to stay back. Every so often, we heard the sizzle and boom of a mortar blast coming from pretty close by. "You're kidding, right?" I said. "What's the problem?" "You can't go out dressed like that, Nige. Not with African soldiers. You just can't." I once appreciated Nigel's love of bright colors and designer jeans, but what he wore now seemed like a mark of his inexperience. Shooting me a withering look, he took off the scarf and set down the sunglasses, but left the rest of his outfit in place. Downstairs, Ajos clicked off a phone call and informed us that the mortars were landing near the Ugandan base by the airport. He deemed minesweeping with the Ugandan soldiers not a good idea for Nigel that morning, but he promised to make more calls to see if we could visit the IDP camp outside of the city, the one where we'd been hoping to go a day earlier. The camp was run by a well-known Somali doctor named Hawa Abdi, a gynecologist in her 60s who had opened a small women's health clinic on her family's farmland back in the 1980s. When the Civil War started in 1991, she began allowing people displaced by the fighting to stay on her land and now had something like 90,000 Somalis living at and around her place. Dr. Hawa was a hero. Despite harassment and threats from Al-Shabaab, she'd expanded her clinic until it was a 300-bed hospital. She also ran health education programs for women. Her two daughters had left Somalia to attend medical school and returned to help do her work. The prospect of interviewing them excited me. "I will tell you in 30 minutes whether it's safe to go," Ajos told us, turning back to his phone. "Please wait." Dr. Howa's land lay about 20 kilometers to the west of where we were staying, just outside the city limits, along what was called the Afgoya Road. The first 13 kilometers of the Afgoya Road sat inside the boundaries of Mogadishu proper and were protected, as much as anything in the city could be protected, by government troops. Neither the transitional federal government nor the African Union peacekeepers had any influence or backup beyond the city. Leaving Mogadishu, we'd be entering the wild west of militia-controlled Somalia. "The two TFG soldiers who'd been acting as our bodyguards for the last few days," Ajos explained, "would be willing to accompany us to the city limits, to the edge of their territory, but no farther. After that, we'd need to hire new guards who weren't affiliated with the government. This would cost us another $150. A few phone calls later, Ajos had everything set up. He'd arranged for replacement guards to meet us on the road a few kilometers after the last TFG checkpoint. In addition to Abdi and our driver, we would have an extra escort for the day, he said, the head of security for Dr. Hawa's camp, who was on his way to the Shamo to meet us. The logistics sounded fine. Besides, what did we have to compare them to? It wasn't like I could say, "Well, last time I drove across the line where the Islamic militias battled the uniformed soldiers, here's how we did it." I loaded my backpack for the outing. My camera, a wide-angle lens, an extra memory card, my iPod, a small notebook, two pens, some lip balm, a hairbrush, a couple bottles of water. I wore a pair of jeans, a green tank top, and some leather sandals I'd bought in Kenya. Over that, I layered the heavy Somali-style abaya that Ajos had borrowed for me from his sister-in-law. Polyester and black, like a long choir robe, along with a somber black headscarf to cover my hair, which was what I had worn each day when stepping outside the hotel. Leaving the lobby about 20 minutes ahead of us, Robert and Pascal from National Geographic climbed into a different SUV with their own hired TFG soldiers. As usual, Ajos was traveling with them. They, too, were headed west on the Afgoya Road, heading off on a drive more dangerous than ours, traversing the same road but continuing on through militia-held territory to visit the coastal city of Mirka. They'd taken extra precautions, hiring a second security vehicle with additional guards. I wasn't paying attention when we rolled out of the Shamo gates. I felt that morning almost like I was in a trance, I'd learned this about reporting work. You switched on and off. There were so many hours spent upright and fretful, navigating all the small things, looking for advantageous viewpoints, asking questions, taking notes, trying always to think ahead. By contrast, time spent sitting in cars, for me, was time off. Our vehicle ferried us through the streets that were more familiar, less jarring than they'd been 2 days earlier. The guy who'd come to escort us from Dr. Hawa's camp, an older man in a white shirt and a Somali-style sarong who spoke no English, had insisted on driving. Our regular driver sat wedged in the middle up front while Abdi rode shotgun. Nigel and I had the back seat to ourselves while the two TFG soldiers occupied the rear. The road heading out of Mogadishu was wide and paved. We bumped over potholes and past shelled-out gray buildings. We passed women selling bananas and mangoes and men dragging carts loaded with cooking oil and firewood. We rounded a traffic circle and cruised through a couple of government checkpoints. The traffic thinned. The sky streamed alongside us. My mind flitted away from where I was. I thought about my mother, who had relocated to British Columbia and found a job in a bakery. She'd sounded happy in our last phone call. It was summertime in Canada. People were grilling hamburgers and swimming in cool lakes. Home was a pleasant thought. In order to get back for a visit, I'd have to sell some stories. I pulled my camera from the backpack, turned it on, and started shuttling through images from the previous days. There were some good shots of the scenery, including some of a stone Catholic cathedral built by the Italians in the 1920s, more recently gutted by bomb blasts. I'd taken a series of photos from inside one of the African Union tanks, showing both the Ethiopian soldiers and their view of the streets below. Now approaching the city limits, we were passing refugees loping along the road, families hauling themselves westward, away from the besieged urban streets. I could see sprawling encampments, dwellings made of tarps stretched over tree boughs that had been bent like hoops, looking like a fleet of ragtag rigged sailboats. Minibuses running between Afgoya and Mogadishu traveled both lanes of the highway. A haze of yellow dust hung in the air. We pulled up at the final government checkpoint, where several dozen uniformed soldiers sat under the shade of a large tent. Someone lifted the hatch on our vehicle. Our TFG guards wordlessly climbed out. Our driver rolled down his window and called out something in Somali to the departing soldiers, and within seconds we were moving again, headed into a short stretch of no man's land that separated the government area from the militia area. The road curved away from the checkpoint. In the front seat, Abdi was talking into his cell phone. I was looking at more photos, a series I'd taken of Nigel sweetly kicking a ball with some children from the old city, when I felt the vehicle slow. I assumed we were meeting our new set of guards. I didn't bother to lift my head. Sitting next to me, Nigel was absorbed with his own camera. But the energy inside the SUV shifted. The air seemed suddenly tinged with electricity. The three Somali men in the front seat were muttering. I looked up and saw a dark blue Suzuki station wagon parked on the opposite side of the road. I then saw someone standing in front of our vehicle, a man with a gun. His head, nose, and mouth swaddled in a red checkered scarf, the kind favored by Mujahideen fighters around the world. His dark eyes bulged. The gun was pointed directly at our windshield. Abdi switched to English. "This could be a problem," he said. More bandits appeared from behind the parked Suzuki, circling our vehicle, guns hefted. About 12 of them altogether. I immediately started hoping for a robbery. Something fast in which they took everything and then vanished. Someone tugged open the back door, the heat spilling into the air-conditioned capsule of the SUV. People were shouting in Somali, male voices. Abdi and the other two men in the front seat were pulled out and thrust into a ditch by the side of the road. I watched Nigel climb out. A man in a yellow scarf yelled in my face. I could see beads of sweat running from his covered forehead down past his nose. He looked young. I raised my arms, like I'd seen done 100 times in movies, and slid my way out into the blaze of sunlight. Was this real? How could it be real? Just then I caught sight of a passerby, a woman, floating like an apparition past us, headed towards a junction in the road. She was looking and not looking, trying to pretend she hadn't seen us, her headscarf streaming behind her as she moved. She walked on without once looking back. I began to understand that what was happening was real. From behind, someone shoved me toward the ditch. I knelt first and then dropped forward into the sand next to where Nigel was lying face down beside Abdi and the two others. I spread my arms and legs as everyone else had done. It got quiet. Someone seemed to be searching our vehicle. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see the narrow cave of a gun barrel pointed at my head, about 12 inches away. My mind and body felt eerily calm. I thought for sure we were about to be shot. The bandits were jabbering at us again. We were pulled to our feet. Abdi, Nigel, and I were waved back into the SUV. I was relieved to see one of the gunmen rifling through Nigel's backpack. It was a robbery after all, I thought. They'd take our stuff and then let us go. Three of the bandits now sat in the front seat. Four of us, Nigel, Abdi, me, and another of the gunmen, occupied the middle. I could hear several more climbing into the hatch. I wasn't sure what had happened to the two other guys, our driver and the security guy who'd come from the IDP camp, but the rest of us were packed in tightly, sucking down what felt like the last available oxygen, smelling like sweat and fear. My own backpack sat at my feet with a fancy camera inside. When were they going to take it? Why weren't they demanding our wallets? The man in the driver's seat turned the key. The vehicle engine jumped to life. We accelerated, falling into place behind the Suzuki, which had executed a quick U-turn and was now leading us. For another minute or so, we rocketed over the paved road and then made an abrupt right-hand swerve onto an unmarked sandy track. Shit. Panic was rising in me. We were moving off the grid. We barreled over scrubby, russet-colored hills, shoulders knocking, heads flailing, as we dodged thorn trees and ran over bushes, not following any sort of path. With every passing minute, I knew we were rushing farther away from anywhere someone would think to look for us. Beneath my abaya, I was sweating heavily. I could feel my jeans pasted to my legs. "Abdi," I said, "what's happening?" My voice came out high and quavering. "No talking," shouted one of the men in the front seat. I took note that he spoke English. Desperate for reassurance, I tried again, my pitch continuing to rise. "What's happening, Abdi? Is everything okay? You have to tell me. Is everything all right?" "Be quiet," Abdi said under his breath fiercely. There was nothing reassuring about it. He was no less terrified than I was. I thought about the cell phone in my backpack. I had a phone number for a Joe's written on a page in my notebook, also in the backpack. But how could I get it? And what would I say? Looking over my shoulder, I could see a gun barrel fixed on my head, and behind the gun, a kid holding it. His scarf had come loose from his face. His cheeks were round with baby fat, his eyes lit with terror when he caught my gaze. He held the weapon awkwardly, as if he'd never done this before. He couldn't have been older than 14, I guessed. As we banged on through the desert, an order was called out from the front seat. The man sitting back with us grunted something in Somali and held out a palm. Abdi translated. He wanted our phones. Of course he did. My heart sank like a stone. I handed over my phone and Abdi did the same. I figured that Nigel's was in his bag, which already had been taken away. I watched as the men powered them down. We lurched to a stop in a flat, empty area, pulling up next to the Suzuki. A man in civilian clothes got out of the driver's side, walked over, and opened my door. He had a black and white scarf draped tidily over his shoulders, but his face was uncovered. He was clean-shaven and in his mid-20s, with thick eyelashes and an alert expression and slightly protruding front teeth. When he leaned in to look at us, his eyes landed intently on me. Hello, he said in relaxed English, his tone soothing as if welcoming me into a restaurant. He showed no interest in Nigel. My name is Ahmed. Please come with me. Ahmed waved me out of the SUV, me only. He was separating us. I didn't turn to look at Nigel for fear I'd betray my panic. Already I was one woman among about 16 men. Now they were taking me away from my one sure ally. I had to pretend it didn't matter. Quietly, I followed Ahmed as he led me over to the parked Suzuki and directed me into the back seat. A masked man slid in next to me. Two more of the gunmen sat behind me. Nobody's body was touching mine, but I could feel the humid closeness of them. The car shot forward again, skidding through the sand. Where is it that we learn the cliche about how talking can help keep you alive? How it's necessary to remind the bad guys that you're a human being. I had an idea about what I should do. I focused on Ahmed, who was up front next to the driver. He had one arm slung over the seat, his neck crooked so he could look in my direction. He was smiling, like a fisherman who'd reeled in something big. As calmly as I could, I started talking. I told Ahmed my name. I told him I was from Canada, a place where many Somalis had come to live. I said I was a journalist, that we were headed to an internally displaced people's camp to help tell the story of Somalia. I said I loved Somalia already, that its beauty was stunning. I tried to sound earnest, girlish even. I cautiously worked a political angle. For the first time ever, I felt grateful that I'd spent those few months working for the Iranians, since old Mr. Najafi in Tehran had taught me a thing or two about how to tweak my words in order to sound less Western, more Islamic. I am saddened, I told Ahmed, by the occupation of your country. I was referring to the Ethiopians and the Ugandans, the Christians, the outsiders. I added that I had worked for an Islamic television station in Baghdad. Sitting next to me in the back seat was a man I would later learn was named Ali. His face was wrapped tightly in a purple scarf, his eyes visible through a narrow slit. If Ahmed seemed friendly, almost a peer, this guy, what little I could see of him, appeared hardened and mean. He was looking at me carefully. "You are a Christian?" he asked in stilted English. This was a loaded question. I knew from my travels that, in the eyes of devout Muslims, it was generally better to be a person of the book, a Christian or a Jew, than to have no religion at all. Yes, I told him, but I have deep respect for Islam. I paused to see how this would go over. Ahmed turned back to regard me. He smiled again in a way that gave me some hope. "Sister," he said, "don't worry, nothing will happen to you. There is no problem here, inshallah." God willing, it meant. He added, "We are soldiers in the Islamic army. Our commander would like to ask you some questions. We are taking you to our base. We think maybe you are spies." I could feel the fear spike in my throat. Journalists often got accused of being Western spies. I tried to keep talking. I was babbling at this point, listing off every Islamic country I'd been to as if that made me more of an insider. There was a golden brown fur rug draped over the middle console in the front seat. "What kind of fur is that?" I said, making a ridiculous attempt to sound casual. "What animal does it come from?" Ahmed ignored the question. He dialed a number on his cell phone and said a few words. A few minutes later, the car stopped again. The back door opened, the guard on my left climbed out, and Nigel, looking pale, got in, having come from the SUV behind us. He was breathing hard, on the verge of hyperventilating. The guard slid in next to him, sandwiching the two of us together. "Nigel," I said brightly, gesturing to the front seat as the car began to roll, "this is our brother Ahmed. These men are soldiers. Ahmed has promised that nothing bad will happen to us." I sounded like an insane schoolteacher, I knew. I was pronouncing my words deliberately, keeping an overcooked smile on my face. Nigel flared his eyes questioningly at me. I flared mine back, unsure what we were communicating, but relieved at least we were together. Inside my head, a battle raged between rational and irrational. Some part of me believed this was only a misunderstanding, that we were unwelcome in this territory with our flashy hotel car and our white skin, and we'd get some sort of militiaman reprimand about overstepping our boundaries before being sent back down the road. Then again, I knew enough from my stays in Iraq and Afghanistan, from following the news in those places, to understand that angry extremists like to behead their enemies. I wasn't sure which thought was the more unreasonable one. Every time the car went over a bump, a gun barrel hit my skull from behind. I felt certain it would get knocked hard enough to go off. "Brother Ahmed," I said, "could you please ask the soldier to take his gun away from my head? I have no weapon, I'm not a danger to you, and it's scaring me." Ahmed said something in Somali to the soldier behind me. The gun was repositioned, but only slightly. I noticed that Ahmed wore a gold watch. I caught a hint of sweet cologne coming off his extended arm. I tried to think strategically, imagining some conversation we'd have with this Islamic commander who was waiting for us, wondering what I could say to persuade him we weren't spies, that they should relieve us of our belongings and return us to Mogadishu. Mogadishu at this point sounded like home to me, like a place worth longing for. I imagined this commander rummaging through our bags, inspecting our stuff. I thought then of our cameras, of the dozens of images we'd shot of the African Union troops and TFG guards on patrol in Mogadishu. Their existence could create the impression that we were allied with the infidels, that we were on the wrong side of the holy war. All they'd need to do was turn on the cameras and start pressing buttons. "Excuse me," I said to the man sitting next to me. "My lips are dry. Is it okay if I open my bag and take out some cream?" The man stared at me blankly, then gestured in a vaguely permissive way. I bent down and began rooting through my backpack with both hands, pretending to look for my lip balm. I felt my cheeks flush with the lie as my fingers found the camera and then located the slot that housed the memory card. Working quickly, I pressed the tiny lever that released the card and then, keeping it trapped between two fingers, I flicked it away from the camera and into the recesses of the backpack. Now at least they'd have to make an effort to see my photos. I grabbed the stick of balm and lifted it with a flourish. Ali averted his eyes as I rubbed it over my lips, but I could tell he was watching. "Sister, why are you not afraid?" "What?" Ali had asked the question, not looking directly at me. He seemed provoked by my confidence, false as it was, angered maybe that I wasn't weeping or begging. I thought quickly and spoke loudly. "I'm not afraid because my brother Ahmed has promised that nothing bad will happen." In the front seat, Ahmed was again talking on his phone. I hoped that he'd caught what I'd said. I could hear Nigel sitting on the other side of Ali, struggling to calm his breathing. I wondered what had happened to his camera. Just then we tore past another vehicle coming in the opposite direction, a truck full of young men with guns. I craned my neck to watch them pass. In 20 minutes of driving, we hadn't seen a single human, animal, or structure. I felt a hard knock on my arm, a smack from Ali. "Why are you looking?" he screamed. He seized the loose end of my headscarf, yanking it over my face. There was an odd terror in his voice. We drove on a while in silence before I again tried with Ahmed. "My brother," I said, leaning forward slightly in my seat, trying to sound friendly, directing my words toward the back of his head. "Is this about money?" He turned to look at me, his face breaking into a wide smile, as if we were alighting on the notion together as a team. Yes, he said, "maybe so. Maybe it is like that." Chapter 17. Tuna Fish and Tea. After about 45 minutes of driving, having briefly rejoined a paved road before pulling out into the desert again, we arrived at a small, maze-like village where narrow sand lanes snaked between a jumble of walled-off properties. The car pulled up outside a large rusty gate made of blue metal. Ahmed got out, produced a set of keys, and unlocked it. The gate swung open, and I could see more masked soldiers waiting inside, in a compound surrounded by high walls. The Shamo SUV was no longer with us. Abdi and the other two Somali guys we'd been taken with were gone. I climbed out, holding my backpack, figuring it would be a matter of moments before they searched it. I counted 9 or 10 masked men, all of them staring at us, guns strapped over their shoulders. In addition to scarves, they wore jeans and collared dress shirts. Their bodies looked lean and young, despite the Q-tip-like wrapping over their heads. And they were keyed up, it was easy to see. It seemed like they'd been ordered not to speak in front of us. One of the soldiers walked over and shut the gate behind us. If this were some sort of army base, it was a small and hardscrabble one. There was a long, low, tin-roofed building shaped like a shoebox, with 3 doors equally spaced on its outer wall. I could see what looked to be a cooking area underneath a lean-to made from hammered together scrap wood and a thick-trunked acacia whose branches hung heavily over the yard. In front of the house, beside the gate, was a small shed, which I took to be an outhouse. I turned to Ahmed. "Can I use the bathroom, please?" I said. He pointed in a solicitous manner toward the shed. "Of course, my sister." One of the soldiers escorted me. I carried my bag with me, hoping nobody would notice. The bathroom had tall concrete walls and no roof. Inside was a stale-smelling, shallow hole cut into the concrete floor. It did not seem to have been used recently. Standing to one side of the hole, I pulled out my camera and switched it on, cringing at the sound of its electronic ping, hoping nobody could see me through the wide cracks on either side of the wooden door. Fishing the memory card from my bag, I reinserted it and quickly hit delete all on the stored photos, erasing the evidence of what we'd done thus far in Mogadishu. For good measure, I squatted down and peed into the hole before exiting. Back outside, the soldier named Ali, the one who'd hit my arm in the car, barked an order to one of the younger-seeming soldiers who approached me with a plastic bucket of water so I could wash my hands. Ali then marched me toward the low building, to a darkened room on the far left, where I found Nigel sitting on a foul-looking foam mat, his shoulders pressed up against a dirty wall. The air was musty. Along the back was a small window with closed metal shutters. A very long time ago, the room had been painted a pale shade of pink. The floor was strewn with bits of electrical wire. Nigel had lit a cigarette and was looking distraught. Ali hovered momentarily in the doorway. He pointed at a mat along the opposite wall, indicating that I should sit. Then he disappeared. Nigel glanced at me. We hadn't had a moment alone since we'd been taken. "What are we going to do?" he said. "I don't know." "We've been kidnapped, right?" he said. "Or is this something different?" I was thinking about the difference between being detained and being kidnapped. I'd been detained once with Enes and an Iraqi cameraman while reporting in Baghdad's Sadr City. A group of armed men had surrounded our car and then taken us to the Sadr Party headquarters, where we'd been questioned about our political affiliations, whether we were loyal to the Sunnis. I'd been able to make a phone call to a Shia contact who exerted some pressure, and we'd been let go within an hour. It had been a hassle and scary, but it had ended quickly, over and done. How I wished for something like that now. Before I could say anything much to Nigel, Ali walked through the door, this time carrying a piece of newspaper. With a flourish, as if wanting to be sure he had our attention, he folded the paper in half, then rolled it into a tight cone, expertly flipping back the tip, his long fingers working around the rim, pressing it into a thin ledge. He leaned down and dropped his creation on the floor next to Nigel, an origami ashtray. Nigel and I stared at it, wordlessly. "Have you seen this before now?" Ali said. His English was accented but understandable, the product of some sort of schooling, I'd guessed. We both shook our heads. Ali was wearing his warrior scarving, but it seemed as if, hidden beneath his layers, he might be smiling. He dropped into a squat not far from where Nigel was sitting, as if settling in. "I used to smoke," he said, "before the jihad." He looked from Nigel to me. "But since 2 years, no smoking." I took this to mean we were going to have a conversation. I tried not to feel terrified of him despite the glare in his eyes and the gun in his hands and the bizarre fact we were sitting, the three of us, in a grubby room in an off-the-grid Somali village, waiting to see what would happen next. I reminded myself that it could only serve us to build some rapport with Ali. Ali, it turned out, had plenty to say about Somali politics and jihad. His jihad was all about driving the Ethiopian troops out of Somalia, which was pretty much the same jihad being fought by the armed groups of teenagers we'd seen charging around Mogadishu in pickup trucks. Ethiopia's population was predominantly Christian. Somalia was a Muslim country and needed an Islamic government, one that enforced Islamic rules, he said. He'd been battling the invaders for 2 years, ever since 2006, when the Ethiopian government sent troops over the border and he signed on with the Mujahideen. As he saw it, it was a straight-up case of Christians meddling in Muslim affairs. He hated the Ethiopians. He hated everything about them. "For 2 years, my life is only jihad," he said from beneath his scarf. He was sitting against the wall now, knees jutting, gun propped next to him. Being a holy warrior in Somalia seemed to involve giving up the pleasures of your former life and marrying yourself fully to the cause. It meant adopting and abiding by the most rigid interpretation of Islamic law. It meant no television, no music, no smoking, and, what seemed to pain Ali the most, no sports. Football, he said with no small amount of wistfulness, had been his game of choice. He'd played it, watched it on television, considered himself a loyal fan of some of the African World Cup teams. We did what we could to work Ali over. We empathized with his struggle. We said, of course, each time he mentioned how hard it was to be battling the infidels all the time. Nigel dropped the names of various soccer stars and team rivalries, which seemed to excite him. But whenever we felt we had even a loose connection starting to build, we'd hit a wall. "Your country," Ali said, waving a finger at the two of us. Forgetting the chit-chat, his voice suddenly spewing rage, "sent the Ethiopians to us." It didn't matter to him that Nigel was Australian and I was Canadian. The differences were insignificant. An unbelieving white foreigner was an unbelieving white foreigner. The Western world was inscrutable and immodest and ruled over by Satan, or Shaitan in Arabic. When we reiterated to Ali that we'd come to Somalia as journalists trying to tell the stories of how the people were suffering, he was wholly unimpressed, suspicious even. I knew that the worries about spies weren't entirely unfounded. I'd read that the U.S. had quietly sent special forces into Somalia to assist the Ethiopians and the faltering transitional government. I'd heard, too, that every so often, unmanned drones passed over Mogadishu, buzzing the city like steel-gray dragonflies. When Ali left the room, closing the door behind him, Nigel and I sat silently in the shadows. What did they want from us? It was hard to know. We tried to buoy each other by reviewing the circumstances. Ahmed had seemed so certain that everything would be okay. Ali brimmed with anger but hadn't done anything to hurt us. Nobody had asked us for money, even. Light leaked through the shuttered window. On the sill was a stack of thick hardcover books, Qurans it looked like, about 8 of them. In the far corner, there was an iron coat rack with some men's clothing hanging from it. The sun radiated across the tin roof above, heating the room like an oven. Beneath my headscarf, I could feel the sweat matting my hair. Outside, men were murmuring. Nigel and I went round and round over the puzzle of what was happening. This is a kidnapping, one of us would say. No, it's not. It's just a misunderstanding, a political thing. Something in the act of debating it made us feel better. After a time, Ahmed poked his head through the door. I will be leaving, he said, as if we were friends parting ways. Be very careful with these men. They will kill you if you don't do as they say. Where was he heading? I was desperate for him to stay. That his English was so dignified and his face was uncovered felt important, consoling. He was the one guy here who didn't carry a gun. I'd been running the words he'd said in the car, "Don't worry, nothing will happen to you," again and again through my mind. "Wait," I said, "what about the commander? I thought he wanted to meet us."
"Ah," Ahmed said, almost as if he'd forgotten. "Inshallah, tomorrow."
Right away, I started to wonder if he'd been lying to us. Was there no commander? Was it possible that nobody would come to hear us out? I'd put all my hopes on this one possibility. I tried to wring whatever I could out of Ahmed. It felt like a last chance. "My brother, I need to ask you one thing," I said. "Can we please call our families? Because if we don't go back to the hotel, they're going to know something has happened to us. Can we just tell them we're okay?"
Ahmed nodded as if this were an excellent suggestion.
"Perhaps," he said obliquely.
"Perhaps that will be the next program."
I told him that if we could at least make a call to Ajos at the Shamo Hotel, he might be able to help everyone get what they needed.
This, Ahmed said with a parting grin, could be another piece of the program.
He closed the door gently, leaving us again in darkness. We heard the squeak of the gate and the sound of his car driving away. With Ahmed gone, Ali appeared to be fully in charge and relishing the role. He was worked up. Any eagerness to talk about his life or the jihad had evaporated. His anger now seemed focused and specific, directed entirely at us. He demanded our money.
"Where is it?" he screamed.
I fumbled in my bag and produced the $211 that I'd brought from the hotel that morning, having left the rest in the Shamo safe. My hand was shaking as I passed it over. Nigel was carrying a few coins and a folded-up $100 bill he'd stashed in his front pocket. Ali counted our money with open skepticism.
"This is all?"
"Yeah," I said.
"I don't believe," he said. The rage was building in his voice. "I don't believe," he repeated. "How can this be?"
Nigel and I said nothing.
"Where is your money?" Ali said.
"It's at the hotel. We left it there." Somehow, I'd become the one who did most of the talking.
"Your passports, give them to me."
"They're at the hotel, too." Ali gave me a narrow-eyed, judgmental look, as if silently making up his mind about something. I averted my gaze, not sure whether it was better to project meekness or defiance in return. My looking away caused him to laugh, a nasty chortle. He walked out the door. I could hear him conferring with the soldiers outside in the yard. Within a minute, he was back. This time, Ali grabbed my backpack and dumped out its contents. In the light cast by the open door, he inspected everything carefully, disdainfully. My camera, my notebook, my water bottle. He took the lid off my lip balm. He examined both sides of my hairbrush. He handled each item delicately as if it might explode. He shook his head, seeming disgusted by the things I'd chosen to carry with me that day. Each time Ali left the room, he seemed to recharge his fury, as if taking hits off a tank full of hatred somewhere just off the patio. After going through my backpack, he stepped outside and then came back almost immediately. He pointed at me, his eyes bulging. "Get up," he said. He touched the shoulder strap of his gun as if to remind me it was there. Ali had a thick, stocky body. Not fat exactly, but well-fed, solid in a way that few Somalis seem to be. I glanced at Nigel and then got to my feet, my knees and back stiff after all the sitting. Ali motioned toward the door. The sunlight outside was blinding. We walked a few steps across the concrete patio. Two stairs led up from the patio to another closed door. Ali pointed at it, signaling I should go inside. For a split second, I hesitated, and his hand thwapped my back hard.
"Do you want me to kill you?" he said.
He gave me a shove forward, and I stumbled on the stairs. The room we entered was small and dark, with a metal cot against one wall. The air was an unmoving envelope of heat. Ali closed the door.
"Please," I said, trying to keep my voice even.
"Do not do this." I searched for his eyes in the dimness and kept talking.
"Please, you're Islamic. The Muslims are the best kind of people. I know this is not good in Islam. Please." I had been thinking about this on the car ride through the desert crammed in with all those men, imagining the things that could go wrong on top of everything that already had. If he heard me talking, Ali gave no indication. He pulled at my headscarf and tossed it on the ground. Then he reached out and grabbed the neckline of my abaya, yanking it down so the snaps popped open and the two sides fell apart. When I lifted my hands to cover myself, he hit me over the head. I yelped in surprise. "Do you want me to kill you?" he said for the second time, and then he pushed me toward the wall. I could see on the other side of the room, on the windowsill, a stack of heavy-looking books, more copies of the Quran. I felt Ali's hands slide beneath the fabric of my tank top and into the cups of my bra. He was fumbling, squeezing. His breath came in sharp huffs. I closed my eyes so I wouldn't have to see his face. With his right hand, he found the button on my jeans and then the zipper. A thick finger probed me between the legs, then quickly pulled away. I felt repulsion, horror, nausea climbing my ribs. "Don't worry, nothing will happen to you." Hadn't Ahmed said that? I was crying, jaggedly, feeling like I had a block of wood stuck in my throat. "This is wrong," I was saying in a croaking voice. "You are not a good Muslim." He gave me another hard shove toward the floor. "You think I need this?" he said, almost spitting the words. "I have two wives. You are ugly, a bad woman." He picked up his gun from the floor and made a gesture indicating that I should dress myself. He acted as if I'd offended him, as if I'd violated his honor instead of the other way around. I was searching for money, just money. "Okay," I said back quietly. With trembling hands, I worked to snap up the abaya, suddenly grateful for the fact that it covered me so entirely. I wrapped the scarf over my head. "No problem, no problem." I hated the words, but that's what came out of me. He ordered me not to cry. He marched me back to the other room. Seeing Nigel on the foam mat in the gritty dark, exactly as I had left him, I felt the tears start to flow again. I squelched a sob. I could see the devastation on Nigel's face, a clear reaction to what he was reading on mine. Before leaving us, Ali jabbed a finger menacingly in my direction. "You are a problem," he said. Nigel and I were pretty sure there was a school right behind our building. We could hear children's voices floating in the air, lots of them. It sounded as if they were playing in a yard, laughing. The Qurans piled on the shelves made us wonder if the compound was part of a madrasa, a Quranic school. But the fact that the floor of every room we'd been in was littered with fuses, old batteries, and bits of wire offered an alternative idea, that this was a place where Mujahideen fighters built their bombs. The truth was, we had no idea where we were. Somewhere west of Mogadishu, we figured. We'd driven a long time at high speed. We'd passed nothing but a few camel herders and that one single truck full of soldiers. Early on, I'd caught glimpses of the bright tarps that made up the internally displaced people's camp toward which we'd originally been heading, but then we'd veered off again into the scrub. I could hear no sounds of cars driving by, no planes flying overhead, only the occasional ping and crackle of the building's tin roof, expanding noisily under the pour of hot sun. It felt like we were in a box inside another box, sealed away from everything we knew. Ali delivered us lunch, a flask of sweet dark tea, some bottled water, and two flimsy blue plastic bags, each containing a glop of cold spaghetti. He also gave us a tin of oily tuna fish. I took a few bites but couldn't eat more. The day's fear had accumulated into an acidic brew that sloshed in my stomach. For a while in the late afternoon, we were allowed outside. Beneath the boughs of the acacia tree, Nigel and I played a few listless games of tic-tac-toe, drawing crosses and circles in the dust, watching the soldier boys out of the corners of our eyes. They were sprawled out in the dirt with their guns, boredom seeming to have set in. Blooming white clouds drifted across a blue sky. I was looking for diversion. "When you were a kid," I asked Nigel, Did you ever play the game where you called out the shapes you saw in the clouds? He looked at me like I was insane. Back inside our room, he began to cry. I was too afraid to put my arms around him or even to move off my foam mattress and over to where he sat. Earlier, Ahmed had asked if we were married, and after giving myself a split second to make a choice,